Hello and welcome to Directions On Point, an interactive and live program with a top newsmaker in location technology. Hi, my name is Joe Francica, Editor-in-Chief of Directions Media, and I'm in Huntsville, Alabama today. I'll be your host for today's webcast featuring Matt O'Connell, the CEO of GOI. Matt, welcome. Glad to have you with us.
Joe, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You bet. Just a little background on Mr. O'Connell. He came to the commercial remote sensing industry in 2001 as the CEO of GOI's predecessor, Orb Image. In July 2010, GOI was ranked 84th on Fortune Magazine's 100 fast-growing companies. In 2008, GOI was ranked 4th on the Washington Business Journal list of the fastest-growing companies in the D.C. area. And in September 2008, for the second year in a row, Deloitte named the company as a Technology Fast 50 Award winner. Also in that year, 2008, Mr. O'Connell was appointed by the Department of the Interior to serve on its National Geospatial Advisory Committee, and he also serves on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Advisory Committee as well. So, Matt, let's get right into the questions. I want to ask you in general about the growth of the remote sensing industry and the Earth observation industry, and where do you think we have to go in order to grow this business, and where do you think you're going to take GOI?
That's a great question, Joe. Well, first of all, everybody knows how fast the industry has grown post 9/11. You know, we realized after 9/11 that we couldn't look at stable places. This is not the Napoleonic era when you have, you know, one huge army facing another army. You have a more dispersed enemy, and you have to look all over the world. You don't know where trouble is going to break out. Second of all, I think that the unclassified nature of our imagery has made it hugely useful. As the director of NGA said last November at the GEOINT conference, Tish Long said, you know, no nation would go into a modern natural disaster relief effort without the unclassified imagery, the satellite imagery, because it can be shared easily, and all relief efforts are coalition efforts. By much the same token, a lot of military efforts these days are coalition efforts, and you can only share imagery if it's unclassified. Pretty much every nation that has classified imagery restricts the distribution of that imagery. So I think that the increased sharing among nations of critical imagery which relates to either a military effort or an unclassified effort has really helped the industry skyrocket, bad pun, but you know, you just look at, first you had no big contracts, then you had the Clearview contract in sort of 2002, you had the NextView contracts in 2003 and 4, and we thought they were big at $500 million each for Digital Globe and us. And then you look at the EnhancedView contract where we got $3.8 billion over 10 years and Digital Globe got $3.5 billion over 10 years. Obviously, there's been huge growth. I think that the next phase is really going to be a function of how many new capabilities can we derive from all of this great imagery that we're collecting. You know, you made a comment that you can make a lot of money supplying governments with imagery. You can do that, but it also costs a lot of money. Our next satellite is going to cost $850 million. If you're building something that expensive, you want to make sure that you use it fully and get as much juice out of it as you can. So we're spending a lot of effort on looking toward two areas. Where we have been investing in on-demand delivery of imagery and also analytics. We stood up a system last year called IQ, which gives users on-demand access to imagery. And we bought a company called Spadak. Those two things were in the works when Tish Long, the director of NGA, said last November at GEOINT that she wanted two things. She wanted on-demand access to imagery. She wanted to put it in the hand of a warfighter. Well, obviously, we felt good about that investment. And then, second of all, she said, I think what we need is deep expertise. We need more than the pixel. And that made us happy because we had signed a letter of intent to buy that company, Spadak, before her speech. I was glad I did. Actually, the founder of Spadak said at the time, well, you ought to be glad you signed that letter of intent because the price just went up based on what she said.
You're right. Let me ask you, expand a little bit about that on-demand delivery, because it does seem like that's one big component of what has to happen to the industry. I want this area now. I want just this area. I don't want to buy a whole image scene like the old days of buying a Landsat scene. How are you going to prepare to deliver kind of that on-demand imagery and cookie cut out the areas that maybe people just want for themselves?
Well, actually, we're not preparing. We're doing it. We started doing it last summer under this with this platform we call IQ. They deliver to NGA under the program that NGA calls RDOG, Rapid Dissemination of Online Geoing. And we allow people to do exactly what you said, Joe. They can chip out just the area that they want to look at. That's really useful to all deployed personnel, whether they're military personnel or disaster relief personnel. You think about any network, the further out you go in the network, the more constriction there is. The pipes get thinner as you get further out in the network. And as the pipes get thinner, you can transmit less information. Well, as we all know, imagery files are huge. So being able to let people chip out just the one little area they want to see, you know, the first image people saw of that cathedral in Haiti with the roof ripped off was ours. Yeah. Well, if you just want to see that part of Port-au-Prince, our IQ system lets them get it quickly, chip out just that part, and suck that down through kind of common telecoms as opposed to having a big, massive sewer pipe that can send you a whole bunch of data. I think it's going to be very important. I think you're right. That's going to really sort of change. I think it's going to change the industry, because we've been in a situation where the industry was started kind of by specialists for specialists, and as you make it easier for people to use any technology, the market gets bigger. Look at the iPad. It's just tremendous.
Yeah.
The iPhone, the iPod, you know, that kind of mass access to stuff has really helped drive demand, and I think that's what this on-demand stuff will do.
So let me just pick up on the second part of that statement you made about SPADAC and the analytics. I mean, that is maybe not necessarily a departure for a company that captures remotely sensed data, but it is an augmentation of the business. It's an ancillary service that you're providing that kind of expands GOI's selection of services. But that means you have to employ some really smart people doing some highly, you know, high predictive analytics. So it takes you into a different realm of remote sensing. So what are the basic services you think that is going to bring you in terms of new business?
Well, you are right. We have a different kind of type of employee now. But I don't think it's actually that different from what we've been doing, Joe. And if you think about it, our origins were imagery collection. But frankly, the oldest part of GOI is based on value-added production. A company called Trifid started in 1987 in St. Louis doing analysis and information extraction for what was then called Defense Mapping Agency. So since 87, we've had this outfit in St. Louis that takes imagery from any source. It doesn't have to be our satellites. It can be the National Technical Means. It can be DigiGlobe. It can be anybody. And you mix that information together to come up with a value-added information product. Well, we've always had that view that it was more than just a pixel. So we saw it as a natural extension. Our biggest product line is collecting imagery. Our second biggest is processing imagery. And then this new one is delivering information solutions based on geospatial data. And while we don't have, you know, rocket scientists in that third category, we are getting a bunch of very interesting people. You know, the director talked about human geography in her remarks at GeoInt. We have a lot of people who are specialists in human geography in the group that we now call GOI Analytics. We no longer use the name SPADAC.
Right.
And these people specialize in, you know, I met one young woman who was getting an MA in gang warfare in Somalia because that was relevant to, as you looked at the incidence of violence and tried to predict where terrorist activity could occur, knowing the human geography was critical. So we're seeing more and more of that. And it's great to see somebody who takes real live geospatial information, and the analytics group has proprietary algorithms that do massive data mining. Well, after they've mined the data, then they look for trends and links and do pattern recognition. You know, if I said to you, Joe, A, B, C, D, you would say E. Well, in looking for geospatial patterns, for instance, our people recently helped do things like break a car theft ring in Alexandria, Virginia. In another major metropolitan area, they helped the cops catch a serial rapist and murderer. You know, where did he strike in the past? What are the common elements in the areas where he struck in the past? If we look at those common elements, we can eliminate a lot of places and say he won't strike here. We may not be able to say he will strike exactly here, but we were able to say to these to the police force, well, why don't you concentrate your efforts on these three areas? And in fact, he went to one of those, and we helped nab him. It really makes it feel good.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point. You know, when I used to do this for a living, it was more or less, you know, map the rocks, map the soils. Now it's being used for criminology and epidemiology and all sorts of applications that we never thought of before. What's making it real to these people? Do they understand, obviously, remotely sensitive information, but is there an educational process you have to do with these folks, or is it the Google effect in that they're all very familiar now with high-end aerial and satellite imagery?
I think the two parts of your question are both right, Joe. I think the mass of humanity now knows about geospatial. You were in a great project. Adina Schutzberg was in, too. Jack Dangerman and I were in it, the Geospatial Revolution on PBS that was produced by Penn State. I think it was great. It helped educate people about what geospatial is. But a couple of the major inflection points in the history of our industry, I would say, are the development of Google Earth, 2005. That really got the world looking at geography on a mass basis, and it showed people how relevant it was to know not just where they were or a thing was, but where it was in context to other things. You know, I am here. Where's the nearest Starbucks? Then another thing was that, oh, gosh, it was a couple of years ago, I want to say 3 years ago, during the Christmas holidays, the hottest-selling electronics device was the GPS. Well, you know, we don't think about it anymore. I went to look for a new car last night, and a lot of them had navigation packages in them. You know, most phones now have GPS in it. So I think those two things drove a knowledge of geospatial information. Even though the people in the street might not call it that, they are thinking geospatially these days. That's great. Now, the other thing that you asked about did involve advanced knowledge, and we do hire a lot of really smart people for analytics because what we have is proprietary algorithms, but we found that really to get the special sauce, the synergy, it's the proprietary technology plus subject matter experts. You get a particular expert in oil and gas. You get a particular expert in predictive policing, in counterterrorism, in mining. You put the two of them together, and that's what really generates the special sauce and makes our analytic product and service so valuable to so many people, whether they're in the government or in commercial applications. I think you didn't ask this question, but I'm going to ask answer a question that's implicit in what you asked, which is to keep the industry growing. I have said for years, one of the things that this industry really needs is more smart young people studying this stuff. We started a foundation called the GeoLife Foundation to give imagery away to colleges and universities that are training people to do this, Penn State, Yale, Georgia Tech. And the young people are using, arguably GeoEye-1 has the highest resolution and highest accuracy. I mean, it's actually not arguable. It's a fact. It's just the highest resolution, highest accuracy in the commercial business. So here are these young guys using the world's most accurate, highest resolution imagery on real problems, like at Georgia Tech, the kids are working with the Van Fosse Institute. Remember that movie, Gorillas in the Mist?
Oh, yeah,
and
sure.
They're looking at how the Congo, you know, it's torn by civil war, how the rebels are clear-cutting the jungle. Well, that has a lot of implications. They are specifically working with the Van Fosse Institute to say, as the rebels are clear-cutting the jungle, how is that affecting the habitat for the gorillas?
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. And then, you know, Yale, the kids are working on urban planning using Mexico City, the world's largest city. I think that it's really important that we help train the next generation of geospatial leaders today, because we need more young people, and we need people who learn from the past but aren't burdened by it, who think outside the box. I really like hearing young people in their very fresh approach to our industry, because they come up with all sorts of ideas that we might not have.
Let me continue on that thread of the business side of remote sensing and ask you about the Indian and Chinese markets. These folks are launching satellites, but there's some barrier of entry for the U.S. satellite data providers. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about that situation.
I think that they are both very promising markets. We do some business in China. You know, we are very careful in China because we want to make sure that we can support people there, but not do so in a way that is seen as awkward by anybody else that we work for. So we are happy to support the Chinese people in their analysis of China. They're doing a lot of work on, you know, where do we put reservoirs, where do we put roads. It's such a huge nation, they need a lot of imagery. I haven't found any barriers to entry there. The market is so huge, I think that there will be a lot of demand for a lot of people. I have been saying for a couple of years that we think that Russia will grow faster. You know, what are they? The Wall Street Journal uses the acronym BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Right.
For a couple of years, China was growing faster for us. We used to say CRIB, China, Russia, India, Brazil. We have two partners in China who distribute our technology today. One's called Beijing East Dawn, and the other's Beijing Spot Image, you know, an affiliate of the French company.
Mm-hmm.
They're both growing very fast, and we continue to see growth there. I will say we put out a press release today on the fact that Russia has really taken off for us. So Russia's growing faster than China. On India, India's a challenging, you know, challenging market. I was there in January, and I said publicly there, and I'll say it again, I love the Indian entrepreneurs. I think it's hard to generalize about a nation as large as the subcontinent, but, you know, some Indians are born entrepreneurs. They're out there, they're hustling, and they're great to do business with. I wouldn't say that I love the Indian bureaucrats. I think the Indian bureaucrats are standing in the way of the growth of some of the Indian entrepreneurs. In India, it's frustrating because, you know, you have a lot of politicians talking about the loss of jobs to India as people outsource IT jobs to India. India wants free trade to work one way. They want to be able to sell their products and services easily in America. We used to distribute the IRS satellites, and there were no regulations on us selling the Indian remote sensing satellite imagery in America. But in India, we formerly were only able to sell through an agency of the Indian government, the National Remote Sensing Center, NRSC. And there has been a recent change. It's an exciting step forward. India has now said that for imagery that's 1 meter or better, licenses to sell in India will be granted to foreign companies on a fairly routine basis, and we're looking forward to that. You know, as an Indian commentator said to me over the weekend, well, the glass is only half full. At least it's half full, but it's still only half full. India continues to protect its own satellites, which currently take images at 1 meter, which is why they won't let you sell anything better than 1 meter.
So it's still a closed market. in a way.
It's still a closed market, a semi-closed market. You know, we're glad that they took this step forward. We look forward to getting a license for our Iconos imagery and selling that at 1 meter. Clearly, we can't sell GOI-1 at half-meter resolution. We don't think that's really in the best interest of India. We think that for India's entrepreneurs to develop, they ought to have access to the best technology. I think the Indian satellites will continue to improve, but I think India is artificially restricting its market to protect its own industries. And what's ironic is they don't realize the risk they are running as a nation. You know, they are feeding a line to American politicians, in effect, to say, hey, we're going to, you know, the Indians are restricting their market to protect their industries. Maybe we should do the same. And I'm surprised that India is taking that somewhat risky approach.
Right, right. Before I move on to some of the questions that some of our registered attendees have asked, I did want to ask you one last question about the business side of GOI, and that is whether you think you'll eventually expand to provide all sorts of remotely sensed data, radar, hyperspectral. People will want real-time satellite imagery, eventually microsatellites. Is that something you look at in the five-year time horizon?
Well, we've looked at it a lot, Joe. And I don't see moving to other sensors in the near term, or at least not GOI ownership of other sensors. What we see as a better approach is with this IQ platform, we can and we want to distribute other sensors. So whether it's radar, you know, Canadian, Italian, German, whether it's our airplanes or other people's airplanes, we are looking forward to distributing all sorts of imagery data through IQ, but that doesn't mean we have to build it, own it, and operate it. I'm not sure that would generate the best return for our shareholders.
Right.
We have looked at sensors like SAR, you know, radar. I think one thing you have to remember is that you do have some SAR birds up there that are doing okay now. Germany has a very accurate product. Italy is said to have a good product, although the Germans would tell you, well, the Italians have more coverage because they have three satellites, but the Germans claim that their imagery is better, their SAR imagery. And then Canada is a different product. It's very wide area, good for monitoring, you know, the ice in the northern Atlantic, which is part of why they built that. But anyway, there's a lot of SAR product out there, and you have to ask yourself, do I really want to compete with that, or why don't I just try to distribute it?
Right.
I think hyperspectral, we've looked at, Joe, and is interesting, but gosh, there is so much data that you really have to spend a fair amount of effort on the processing once you get it down to the ground. I think airborne's hyperspectral might be more interesting than satellite hyperspectral. You remember, we actually did launch a hyperspectral sensor. This is how I got my job. Orbital Sciences in 2001, well, actually a week after 9/11, launched OrbView 4, which had a hyperspectral sensor on it. Unfortunately, the launch misfired. The sensor never went into operation. But we did look at the market back then, and you know, as I looked back at the research once I got here, I thought, I don't see enough demand right now for hyperspectral, so I don't think we're going to build one. I think there's a lot of demand for getting more products that are based on the information that's already inherent in simply EO, you know, the straight off the rack, four bands of color and black and white. There's a lot of stuff you can do that we should do, and I think that's really what people want, is they want on-demand. And I hear you about the microsatellites. I think that's a question of cost-benefit, and yeah, we are certainly in a big budget crunch right now. I don't think that people should be talking about pie-in-the-sky stuff. You have to focus on what's the real value to the user, whether it's the U.S. government or a commercial user, you know. As it is, we are a very cost-effective supplier to the U.S. government. because we sell a third of our imagery to international and commercial people, our government and the U.S. taxpayers benefit mightily from the fact that they're not paying, you know, 100 cents on the dollar for every picture. We're sharing that cost with other users, whether it's Google or international customers. It's a terrific bargain for the taxpayers, and I think that's why GOI and DigitalGlobe got those contracts under the Enhanced View contract. It's just a great deal for the taxpayers.
Yeah, I would agree, only because there's a lot, as you say, a lot more information that can be extracted from the straight 4 and 8 band imagery that's being collected now. And hyperspectral, while it may be overkill, is probably something that is so niche at this point that it's only going to augment existing studies. It's certainly not going to replace anything that we can do with the resolution that we've got currently. And in fact, it's probably, it kind of dovetails into that first question from the audience about the data continuity. I think actually you've kind of answered that question. So let me kind of go to the next one about ClearView and how it's faring in the budget crunch.
I think you mean EnhancedView, and I think EnhancedView is doing okay. As I said, we are very cost effective. And that's important because you have all this uncertainty around the budget. Now, I'm one of the first guys to say, gosh, I said this, I think 10 years ago, I remember getting into a debate with people. America has to do something about these deficits. This is no way to run a railroad. We can't go on like this. Having said that, as Congress looks at the budget issues, what most people do when they're tight on money is, let's spend money where it's cost effective, especially if it's cost effective and vital. And here, we are not only cost-effective and vital, we're vital to national defense. Let's not spend money where we don't see a clear return. So if I was involved in big hardware programs like aircraft carriers and expensive jet fighters, I'd be a little worried. And you see some major defense contractors saying, you know, we might get out of the business of building aircraft carriers. But it's different where you have a real focused expense that generates such real value. Again, you know, our satellites look expensive, but remember, you know, we are a fraction of the cost of the government-owned satellites, and you can go back and look at the cost of the birds that were proposed under the FIA program. Those numbers are public. I think that as we go forward, you know, the NRO is right now on a hot streak. I think General Carlson has done a great job, and that place is hitting on all cylinders. But there is not infinite money. So yeah. I think the NRO is going to focus on doing the voodoo that they do so well, which is the really high-end stuff, the really expensive birds that do the exquisite stuff, and that's what they should do. I think what you see under the Enhanced View program is that NGA, the Pentagon, and the DNI, and the Capitol Hill guys all got together and said, look, a more efficient way to spend our fewer dollars is the NRO should focus on the really high-end stuff, and the area collection, the mapping mission, should be done by the commercial guys because it's faster, better, and cheaper. And that's what they did with EnhancedView. Said, for the next 10 years, this is what you get. And so we're confident that if you look at the price point of the information the government's getting, they're getting a really good deal on all this imagery. It gives them long-term supply. I'm not sure if that's what the question on data continuity addressed, but you know, we had to propose 10-year coverage so that they were assured of supply for 10 years. That's a lot of money, $3.8 billion. We have one satellite now. We have to build two more. It's a matter of public record that our new satellite's going to cost about, the whole program costs about $850 million. So you're talking about two more satellites. That's a billion and a half, roughly, over the next 10 years.
Right.
So there's a lot of expense to get that $3.8 and the government gets a lot of value.
Well, so let me put it back on you then. What do we have to do a better job of justifying the cost of these missions and maybe the ROI in geospatial in general? Is that something that's realized? You know, do you have to bring it to the Science and Technology Committee in Congress and say, look, you guys are getting a bargain? Do we have to do a better job of justifying the ROI?
I don't think so. I think that the government is aware of the ROA. You know, there are a lot of people looking at a lot of ways to save money, and as I said, I think we have to save money. But we are, in effect, saving them money right now, which is, I think, one reason why Enhanced U got the support it did when it did. And I think it will continue to have support. I think what we have to do is, if you think back about the two areas that the director talked about last year in November at GEOIN, make this more easily accessible by people, make it easier for people to access it quickly, and derive more information from the stuff you have before you go building a lot of new stuff like hyperspectral. That all generates value without costing more. You know, I mean, you know this better than I do. You are in this business. I think everybody who is a listener of yours knows that proper use of geospatial information helps any decision maker make decisions faster, more effectively, and more cost effectively too. We literally save people time and money. And I think this industry is going to continue to grow as people realize, geez, if I'm planning a new business, if I'm looking for a new home, if I want to look at where there might be a natural disaster, use of geospatial information saves people money before and after. So it's just going to keep growing. It's not just about war anymore. It's about how much value this industry creates for all the decision makers, whether they're public or private.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways we're still just scratching the surface and some of the value that we're bringing to all sectors, not just government, but private industry as well. And I do hope that continues. We had one question here, and we're kind of running out of time, but I wanted to get to it. And one of the people who registered for the for this broadcast asked, will the coming GOI-2 satellite deliver less than 50-centimeter imagery to the public, or will the U.S. government restrict access?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, let me thank you again, Joe, for having this, because sure, every time you do one of these, you help more people learn about this industry, and you help encourage the dialogue in the industry. And I think both of those are good for advancing the tradecraft, advancing the way we use this information. Now, on this specific point, currently, we will collect at 0.33 meters, 33 centimeters. That will be available to the U.S. government. The current policy of the U.S. government is that if we apply to the government for a waiver so that we can deliver that information directly to a military ally of the United States, they may give us a waiver on a case-by-case basis. And, in fact, we've got some of those waivers for GOI-1. GOI-1 images at 0.41 meters. Since that's better than the current limit, which is half a meter, we have to get waivers, and we've done that. Now, we hope that the government will look at loosening the reins. We honestly think that it would be good, especially if you look at this cost-effectiveness issue we were talking about and the deficit issues. You know, the more they let the private sector sell to commercial and international customers, the better NGA is, because by reducing our cost, in effect, we don't have to charge them as much. Now, you could say our prices are fixed under Enhanced U going forward, but obviously there's room for a trade-off to benefit the government if they'll relax this stuff. We also think it's important from a competitive standpoint. You know, we're happy to compete with people around the world. This industry, I think, more than any, relies on coopetition because, as I said before, spot images are, we sell through them in Beijing. We sell through spot image in Singapore.
Right.
There's a lot of coopetition, you know, and everybody's so intertwined. We sell to Google. Spot sells to Google. We sell to Esri. We've just done a big deal with Esri. We're looking forward to seeing them at their conference in a week or two. The fact that everybody's interconnected kind of makes it harder for America in some ways, because the foreigners don't have the same restrictions we do, and they can produce at different levels and sell at different levels. No one has gotten below half a meter yet, but, you know, I think that the French will keep working at it, the Indians will keep working at it, the Koreans, the Japanese, and I think long-term, America can't be quite as insular. We can't sit back and say America has the best technology, and I think America currently does have the best technology, but we can't just sit there and rest on our laurels. We have to really realize that we're in a competitive industry, and if you put a restraint on, you have to be sure you are benefiting from that restraint. If other nations can create sensors that collect it better than half a meter, then why should America prohibit American companies from selling at half a meter? We think that they ought to go down to, say, 25 centimeters, and we hope they do before we launch GOI-2. So that gives me a time horizon. You know, we're going to, that thing goes live roughly Labor Day of 2013. I mean, it'll be up and running before then, but NGA has until Labor Day 2013 to certify GOI-2's imagery, and, you know, we have a team working to try to persuade NOAA and the Intel community that there really is not as much benefit from that restriction as there is harm.
Right. Well, we'll see. We'll see how that plays out, because it certainly would be a benefit to the industry as a whole. Well, Matt, I think we have run out of time, and I really do appreciate you spending a few minutes with us and giving us your insights and telling us about what GOI is up to next. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, and we appreciate being on the phone call, Joe.
Good. And thanks to all of you, our listeners. We will hopefully see you on another Directions On Point or another Directions Media webinar or our weekly Directions On the News podcast that are syndicated on iTunes. Bye for now, and be sure to tell a friend about Directions.